day two. I'm glad to see that many of you made it back. I know the last lecture of the day can be the hardest because it's latest in the day and you've already been jam-packed with lots of information. So I'll try to make this not too painful. But let me just start by reminding you all what it is that we talked about last time. So we started by talking about sort of the need for dark matter, just kind of basically going through some of the rough evidence that exists that tells us that particle dark matter is a solution to the missing mass problem. And then we really walk through in detail different aspects of the event rate formula for how many events you might expect in your detector or could expect in your detector. And part of that exercise was really to help point out what sorts of uncertainties can arise in these calculations of event rates and where is it that perhaps there might even be more theoretical development that's needed, or once we saw a signal, what other sorts of physics could we perhaps contribute to the depth of knowledge? Then after we finished that, we started talking about the dark matter signal itself and its characteristics. And primarily, you saw it was a really flat spectrum that was pretty unordinary. But I did point out there were a couple of unique features of the signal that you could experimentally use to try to get a handle on what is an actual signal versus what is just a background or a faked event. And one of those handles was an annual modulation that's due to the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun. And then the second signal or characteristic of a signal that if you were able to develop a sensitive enough detector is you can actually also detect the fact that the Earth rotates on its axis and it's at some angle. So there's actually a direction over the course of the day that if you could directionally see what direction your dark matter particle is going in, you could try to distinguish that, you know, from a background event. So we don't have a whole ton of handles. It's not like for those of you who do physics related to searches at colliders, where you're looking for resonances or peaks. You know, looking for dark matter, it's a little bit harder, at least when you're doing the direct detection. And then we started talking about different considerations of the types of particles and the sources of particles that would cause sort of background events that could mimic dark matter signatures in detectors. And those backgrounds, I said, so we're looking at them right now through the lens of dark matter, but those same backgrounds and those same considerations all equally apply to neutrino experiments that are underground. Depending on the type of neutrino physics you're doing, they may not be as problematic or troublesome. You may not need quite as stringent criteria. So perhaps if you're doing a solar neutrino experiment or you're looking for supernova, neutrinos coming from supernova explosions, both of those we do or have some aspect of or done some aspect of in the past at SNOLAB. But in the future, we're anticipating getting a ton-scale neutrinoless double beta decay experiment at SNOLAB, and we're working to make that happen. That experiment would require very stringent background criteria, and so the things we're talking about today would equally apply to that type of physics. And I'm hoping on Friday to be able to talk a little bit about neutrinoless double beta decay. So just trying to, you know, put into perspective what we're talking about today. All right, so the next natural step, now that we've sort of identified where those sources of backgrounds might come from that you would worry about, is starting to identify the handles you have to like identify something as a background or to remove that background from consideration. And the very first thing that you might think of is there some kind of signature that you can look for, an event signature that would determine whether or not you have a background particle or whether or not you have an actual real dark matter candidate. This idea of having an event signature, it's also something that neutrinoless double beta decay programs would use. It's sort of a common thing, although the techniques of how and what that signature might look like would be different. The idea of having an event signature is universal. So the most problematic backgrounds turn out to be interactions from neutrons that result from alpha N and fission reactions. And these are from the decays of uranium and thorium. And uranium and thorium can exist in the rock wall, in the laboratory walls themselves. You're underground. The concentration of uranium thorium underground is a lot more concentrated than it is above ground. You can think about this. So yes, in Canada, we have basements. This used to be something in Texas that I used to have to say, so if you lived in the Midwest, you'd have this thing called a basement. But I don't know how many of you are familiar or have had a basement. My basement in Canada, there's actually like a little pump, and there's a switch on the wall that I can turn the pump on or turn it off. And what it does is it filters out essentially the radon in the basement. It's for air circulation and flow. My house is relatively new, so I'm not sure how much this technology exists, but I remember saying to the real estate agent, why wouldn't you always just have this on? Why is there a switch? Of course you want the radon removed from your basement. And so, you know, for those of us who've lived in areas where there are basements, like we know that like it's bad to have a lot of that in your basement concentrated, because if you're breathing it in, it can be a cause of lung cancer over long periods of time. And this is why if you're going to occupy your basement, in the United States, this is true. I'm sure it's true to some extent in Canada, hence I have this pump I can turn on and off. If you're going to like put a bedroom or a living space in your basement in the United States, you actually have to have your house tested for radon, your basement tested for radon. And then they tell you based on those measurements whether or not you need to have this like additional circulation sort of pumping system to help filter out the radon in your basement. So anyway. That's just sort of a long kind of issue to say like radon's a serious problem. You go deep underground, it's even more concentrated because it's just naturally there in the environment. The other issue is that the materials you're building your detectors out of actually have your uranium and thorium naturally in them. Potassium 40 is another element that we worry about. And so these are all things you take into consideration. So if you have an event signature, that can help you identify what's happening here. Essentially, when these particles decay, you'll get gamma rays, you'll get potentially beta particles that are coming partway down, you'll get alpha particles. All of these can be problematic. For the most part, in a detector, you can tell, so you want to be able to distinguish how the recoils happen. Most detectors we'll be able to distinguish an electron recoil, so a particle coming in and scattering off an electron, or a nuclear particle, so a particle comes in that scatters off the nucleus. So most backgrounds that you see in experiments are photons and electrons, or even, you know, electrons from beta decay, which we call betas, that are scattering off electrons, and WIMPs scatter off the nucleus, and neutrons do as well. And so the idea is that if you have really strong discrimination, you know, a lot of your background can just be rejected by doing an event discrimination, and then what you're left with are just the neutrons. Let's say if it is that you're looking for a dark matter candidate that's scattering off your nucleus, all right? So how is it that you could get this discrimination? Like, how would you be able to tell the difference between an electron recoil and a nuclear recoil? That's where the detector response comes into account. So the idea is that your interaction happens. So this big star here is my dark matter candidate has smashed into a nucleus, or I have an electron, or I have a photon that has smashed into an electron. And created, it's dumped energy into the detector. And so, yeah, think about what handles do you have for measuring that energy? Well, depending on your detector medium, you either might get energy going into scintillation, you could get energy going into ionization, or you could get energy going into phonons. And many detectors actually take advantage of using measuring two different quantities here. So if I'm able to, for example, in the case of the CREST experiment, these are scintillating crystals. And so when a particle interacts in those crystals, they are able to measure both the light output, the scintillation energy, and they're able to measure the ionization energy. And when they take the ratios of the ionization energy to the phonon energy that's deposited, they're able to discriminate the difference between nuclear recoils and electron recoils. Really, it kind of goes this way. And actually, CREST is really interesting, and we'll look a little bit closer at this experiment probably tomorrow, but maybe later today, because the crystals they use are made out of essentially calcium, tungsten, and an oxygen, O4. So they're able to actually see in their data events that are scattering off calcium versus tungsten versus the O4. So they actually can even discriminate at that level, which is pretty cool. Okay, so what you need to also know about, or what you have to realize, like when you're using then, let's say that you're using this measurement and you're using sort of two different types of energy deposits. So as I said, the WIMPs and the neutrons are scattering off your nuclei, giving you a nuclear recoil. And in the literature, you will see this often as capital N, capital R. That's sort of the standard notation for it. Similarly, the backgrounds are scattering off of electrons most of the time, in a WIMP model, always. In many models that are where you're having that interaction, that would be called an electron recoil. An ER is how it's abbreviated in literature. There are dark matter models where the scattering is actually happening on an electron. So that is possible in case you have that question, but I wasn't going to talk about that in too much depth. And different detectors have different responses to this nuclear recoil and these electron recoils. And so if you're going to take advantage of this different response that your detectors have, you have to know something about the quenching factor. Okay, so the quenching factor is what describes the difference in the amount of visible energy in these detectors to the two different types of events, so the electron recoil and the nuclear recoil. And just to make this one, just to add one more step of complication to this, which really is there to try to be clarifying, in our community, we use these sort of funny units. So you all, I'm sure, measure energy in KeV, right?
GeV,
okay. You measure it in EV, right? We decided that's just too simple. And we want to be really clear. So we actually talk about two different energies. We talk about events that when we're making the assumption that the event is happening as an electron recoil, when we make those assumptions and we are quoting results or we're talking about results, we talk about a unit called a KEVEE for electron. So it's an electron event. And when we're talking about energy that's measured where we are assuming that the event is happening due to a nuclear recoil, we'll call it KEVNR. Okay? Why EE? EE is electron equivalent. NR is nuclear recoil. Electron equivalent means like, you know, from an electron recoil. I don't know. I mean, yeah, you might think ER would make it seem more, more natural and more consistent, but the EE is actually electron equivalent. Yes, and I'm going to talk about how you convert between these units and why these units are there later, but yes.
I noticed yesterday that it's like you used that one point, like KVR. What is that?
Yeah, so that would have been NR for nuclear recoil. So like recoil, yeah. So as generally when we're assuming a nuclear recoil, and again, this is where the notation has evolved a little bit over time. I'll have to go back in my notes and try to figure out where that is for clarification. But it really means like, are we thinking about like the nuclear recoil energy, or are we thinking about an electron equivalent kind of energy to the recoil? And once I have some slides, and I have a whole, you know, I think a couple of slides exactly on this, including an illustration that shows, you know, graphically how this changes for two different events. And I think that will help you at least solidify in your mind. I mean, it all has to do with the fact that you have these kind of quenching factors going on, and it's sort of the context of how you're talking about the energy. So almost in a sense, it's not really a calibration, but it's kind of like a calibration. Are you calibrating it to an electron equivalent, or are you calibrating the event more like it's a nuclear recoil? Here's actually a little formula to help you see it. The visible energy that you see in KeV, an electron equivalent, is the quenching factor times the energy of the recoil in KeV measured as a nuclear recoil. So this quenching factor here is what you need to know to convert between recoil energy and KeV, the electron equivalent energy. Okay, and like I said, I will go more into this in a bit, but essentially going between the two energy scales, essentially you're using calibration sources, gamma and neutron calibration sources, to help you define what this quenching factor looks like in order to get you, and what your conversion factor will look like going between the two scales. And for people who get really into this and want to know details, I even have a reference in the slides to a student thesis who goes through it in a lot of detail. So, all right. So particle-dependent responses. So it's basically you're taking the simultaneous measurement of energy in two channels to allow this. And so, okay, I think I'm going to have trouble with that as a laser pointer. So basically, at the top here, I'm roughly giving you a schematic of three different types of detectors. The top one is, imagine something like the xenon N-ton experiment. Oh, great. So up here, you can imagine you have something like the xenon N-ton experiment, or the LZ experiment, or dark side. So your favorite liquid noble experiment, filled with xenon, and is being read out with phototubes. You could have your germanium experiment, like super CDMS or silicon, where you're reading out with electrodes for the ionization signal and TESs, or transition edge sensors. These would read out essentially the vibrational energy that you're getting. So these are reading out phonons. Or this is like your CREST detector here, where you have a crystal that scintillates. And so you're using TESs and also I haven't driven on here phototubes, essentially. So if you have something like a liquid noble experiment, you would basically, this here axis, the y-axis in all of these experiments is called yield. Okay, and the yield is the ratio of one type of energy over the ratio of another type of energy. And so if you have, in the case of xenon, you would measure essentially charge over photons. And I'll talk a little later about how it is that they, essentially are measuring measuring charge, ionization energy. And so, you can see here, these black dots here are their background from, this is a calibration source. So these are like either electrons or probably really mostly gamma rays. And then these gray dots here would actually be coming from a neutron source. So the advantage of neutrons looking just like your signal, looking like WIMPs in your detectors, is that you can use neutron sources to calibrate what your signal might look like in your detector. And so you can see that there is separation between the two. In something like this, where you're measuring charge over phonons, in this case, actually, it turns out these detectors in germanium work in such a way that if your charge is exactly one, like if you could measure perfectly, if your yield is one, you essentially have an electron or electron recoiling event. So that would be an electron or a gamma. And if you have a yield around 0.3, that would be a neutron or a dark matter, a WIMP particle that is interacting with your nucleus. So nuclear recoils are way down here. So you have this really great separation. In the case of scintillation versus phonons again, here are your background events, your electron recoils. Here are your nuclear recoils. So all of these that I'm showing you here are calibration source plots. Like, obviously, I mean, if we saw this many WIMPs, we would be, you know, ecstatic, but that's not where we are. All right. So I think I already said this. So essentially, your visible energy or your charge energy is about one-third of your electron recoiling energy when you assume a nuclear recoil. So that means your quenching factor is something on the order of 30% in germanium. Okay. Now, there are other ways and other techniques you can use to try to get rid of your backgrounds. And so this is an example from the bubble chamber. So this would be like Pico, for example. And so the idea here is that if I take a look at the amount of energy per unit length that's deposited, and I plot that versus energy, what you're seeing in here are different types of events, and the spectrum that they give in energy, their spectrum for energy versus, you know, the length, the amount of energy deposited per some unit length. You can see it for radon. You can see it for alphas. And so the idea here is that you can actually take your detector and you can change the pressure under which that vessel is. And when you change that, so here's like 15 psi in green, this is the only region in which you would get a bubble to nucleate. And so if you did that, you would have no electron events in your detector. If I tighten that more to like 65 psi, then only this region up here is. And so what you can see is by tuning the pressure of the vessel, you can make it so that your background events can't produce a bubble, and hence you reject your background just by tuning the detector's pressure to only be sensitive to nuclear recoils.
Would you also, with that, lower your sensitivity to low energy
events? Yes, I mean, you would hurt yourself by exactly what you're saying. And there's actually, so there's a bit more to the story. We'll talk a little bit more about these detectors also. So there are some other challenges that they encounter, and they found some ways around, like the alpha events that they get from radon and stuff. They actually have a way to tag those out. So there is some, a little bit more flexibility, but indeed, all of these detectors, you know, have to look at their trade-offs. So another option they could have is to like characterize, if they really understand their backgrounds very well, they could try to characterize them and subtract them off. Although we don't really subtract backgrounds in that way so much, a lot of this is going into like profile likelihoods and such. But the basic idea is, so I like to think I'm not that old, but when I started in the dark matter business, I mean, cut and count is what we did. We were like, take a cut, you know, anything below, any dark matter particle that's say below, you know, 20 GeV in mass, you know, we're just gonna make a hard cut. Anything below the threshold of you know, depositing a nuclear recoil of say 20 KeV, we're not even gonna look at it. So we're only looking in this window. And now, you know, we can do a lot more because we understand the background so much better. We have better tools for the analysis techniques. But the point is that, you know, back in the olden days, these cut and count methods were what people were using, what we were using, and we were doing a really good job with it. And then the backgrounds got more challenging. As we wanted to make the detectors do more and more, it became more challenging to deal with the backgrounds. And we learned a lot more about the backgrounds over the course of a couple of decades. And so we would have never been able to do something like a profile likelihood back then. We wouldn't have gained much even out of, you know, using something like a neural net or any of those types of techniques, because we just didn't have the complexity. I mean, literally, it was like a two-variable analysis. That's kind of maybe oversimplifying it a bit. We did do some quality cuts, but like it was like such a straightforward analysis. Now, you know, that we understand our backgrounds a lot better and we can start making models of what your backgrounds might be and what the signals are, the cut and count method just doesn't deliver the type of sensitivity we can do. And so now we're all using a lot of like profile likelihood analyses or multivariate techniques. I think some people are even starting to dive into what could AI do for you, things like that. But those techniques all require very accurate background models. And so that's where backgrounds and understanding those backgrounds become really important.
If you just did the cut and count, how much of a hit do you take? Is it like order magnitude, or is it?
It's quite a bit. I'm trying to think the last cut and count analysis that we did was so long ago that I don't even have a comparison that would make sense nowadays. So for Super CDMS, when we were putting in the proposal, part of it was to try to get a quick result out and then develop background models and stuff and do a more stringent profile likelihood analysis. That's not really the plan anymore, but that's maybe the closest thing I can think of that gives you something accurate. And I think we were anticipating something like a factor of 4 or 5 improvement on our results by using a likelihood analysis. That was our assumption at the time based on, you know, what you can hand wave, you know, with simulation and experience. All right, so one of the things I was talking about then is cosmic rays. I mean, this is the whole reason we're underground, right? Is that there are a lot of backgrounds that are induced by cosmic rays interacting, you know, in the detectors. You can reduce, even with a few meters of water equivalent, and I realize that this has been auto-corrected. somehow Apple doesn't think that MWE is what I really meant, but that should be an MWE. And so actually, before I go on, let me talk a little bit about meters water equivalent, because this is a unit I had trouble with when I was a graduate student, because people talked about it like I was supposed to know what it meant. And I thought it was just me, so, you know, whatever. And I never would explain it. But then I started realizing that, you know, some people around me really didn't know what that meant. And some of them were, you know, postdocs and things like this in other fields. So I thought, oh, hey, maybe it isn't so weird that I didn't know what it meant. But essentially, when we go to these different sites around the world, some of them are deeper, like physically deeper than other sites, but the overburden, so the type of rock or material that is between the lab and the surface, can be different. So it might be norite rock, or it might be limestone, or whatever it might be. And all of those materials have different sort of absorption and scattering sorts of lengths that you would need to take into account to know what the actual muon flux is at the level of your lab. So the way that we compare labs, like if we want to compare whose lab is deeper, we don't actually go by depth. I mean, if we did that, Jiaping in China wins. We go by your measured muon flux underground. And under that scenario, we win. And that is the scenario you want when you're putting your detectors like underground, right? You want it from a physics perspective, it's the muons that you care about, not how deep the mine actually is. And so this is actually one of the first papers that ever came out about looking at the depth in meters water equivalent versus the intensity of different types of processes that that are going on when their cosmic rays are striking the Earth and and going through different levels of rock. There is not really a lack of underground laboratories in the Northern Hemisphere. There's only one in the Southern Hemisphere. But basically, we're up here in Canada. This is the Sudan mine, WIP. That's the one in South Dakota. Yes?
What does the green indicate, or the different colors?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember.
Because there's two in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yes.
Oh, I forgot about this one. Yes, you're right. There is that one in Chile now. Yep. Sorry, I forget about that one. Okay. Or actually, I think it's in Argentina. But anyway. So basically, 17 underground sites worldwide that we have for physics research. Not all of the sites that I put up are equivalent. Some of them only host one or two experiments or are not very deep. Others of them are like Gran Sasso in Italy or us here up in Canada at SNOLAB, hosting multiple experiments and are really, really much bigger. So this is basically, if you want to take a look, the hadronic component of cosmic rays is pretty much negligible with about 10 meters of water equivalent, but it's the muons that are penetrating much deeper, producing high energy neutrons, and those can produce the KEV recoils and detectors when they're attenuated by either the rock that on their way down or the shielding material that you even put around your detector. So the shielding that you use to shield out these things can also induce them. The types of processes that we worry about, negative muon capture, photonuclear reactions, deep inelastic muon nucleus scatters, hadronic interactions of nucleons. And this is just basically, so this is sort of a comparison of the total muon flux versus the overburden in that unit of meter water equivalent. And so in reality, Jiaping is much, much deeper than us. But what you can see is that, background-wise, we're pretty comparable. And it does get a little bit tricky. Jiaping and Gran Sasso are actually drive-in labs where you can just be like on a highway and just drive in, and it's really convenient. We're not like that. We're like ride a cage down and then, walk 3/4 mile.
Before you wrote that plot, so the way you're explaining the overburden MWE unit, I thought in practice it sounded like operationally the way you measure that is you measure the muon flux. But your plot shows that that's not right, right?
So it's literally, it is literally like if you take, it is taking the overburden you have and converting it to, if you had the equivalent of a meter of water over top, and what would the reactions look like that way?
So you have to actually kind of drill down and see what the.
So you don't really drill down. Okay, so these are not super accurate in that you're taking a core sample all the way down and then you're calculating every variable. A lot of times, there's geological surveys of these sites, and so you know what the majority of the rock overburden is. So in Sudan, we have norite rock. That's our primary overburden. In Sudbury, sorry. In Sudan, when we were there in Minnesota, it was some kind of green span something another rock. That was the majority of it. That said, we did in Super CDMS, for example, do an analysis, and I had a postdoc working on this, that really needed very much more accurate models of what types of rock there were going through the different levels. And so we worked with a geologist at the University of Minnesota who had studied the rock formations and composition of the region, and were able to get better maps.
When you're deciding how much water would be equivalent to the rock, what you're using to decide that is not the muon penetration rate. It sounds like you look at different kinds of radiation, or what is it that? you use as your meter stick.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. Okay, so it is using the muon flux, but it's not, you know what, I need to get back to you here because I don't remember on this, okay, this specific plot that I chose here, I don't remember the difference between the red and the blue in terms of, and I don't have, and I made the mistake of not actually putting the, the key up, the legend, okay? And so I think what's going on here that these two lines have some different assumptions on it. Most of the, like a lot of times different people make these plots, but there certainly will be the plot that gets made where the two of these are put on, like where everybody's on the same sort of line. And then you wouldn't, you know, see quite as much separation. So there are two things that are being measured here, and I am not positive the distinction between those mines that were, those underground sites that were put on the red line versus the one on the blue line. So the input here has two different assumptions, and I don't know what it is. I will have to look at this paper. This paper would tell me.
The blue ones are all mountains, and the red ones are mines, or?
Oh, actually, yes, that's true. These are all drive-in, now that I think about it. Okay, and that tells you the difference. Okay, now I know what this is. Okay, thank you. It's like, so these are all the, these mines, Sudbury, Boble, Sudan, and Whip, these were all mines where you go under, like, in it, so your overburden is completely calculated by, you know, an overburden. But when you have a drive-in mine, like you're driving into the side of the mountain, like it's the difference of your overburden looks like this and your overburden looks like that. So is it flat or is it a triangle? And so that can alter your calculation a bit and your uncertainty in it. And so I think that's why you're seeing this offset here, because then, you know, it gets like that adds a bit of uncertainty because, you know, when your overburden's like this, it's very simple. It's all easy. And part of the reason that Canada, the like Sudbury would, you know, is so much more favorable. So Jieping is at 6,700 meters of water equivalent, but because you have this sort of mountain shape, when it comes to the muon flux, right, you have kind of lines of sight that make it so that, you know, you get a larger muon flux than you otherwise would if it was just flat over top. Thank you for noticing that. That makes complete sense. And it even says that in my notes now if I look at it more closely.
Apparently meters water equivalent is justified as the product of depth times density.
Yeah.
Which is not equivalent to muon attenuation.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yep. All right. So next, activation of materials. Okay. So, so this has everything to do with the idea that when your detector or your detector materials, your shielding materials are close to the surface or on the surface, whether it be during, you know, production of the material itself, so you're growing the crystal, whether it be while you're fabricating the detector, so you're putting sensors on your crystal, it's another area of concern. So the cosmic ray spectrum varies with your geomagnetic latitude, and the flux itself varies with the height above the Earth. The difficulty with the activation, and if you're trying to calculate this out too, is that cross-section production of isotopes, it's not measured for every isotope. So for some you have measurements, some you don't. The production itself is dominated by neutron reactions, about 95%, and then about 5% are proton reactions, so this is neutron or whatever. And so This is just an example of a chart for some isotopes that we do have measurements for. And so basically, this is a chart that I stole from SuperCDMS. This is basically talking about the different isotopes that can occur in the production of germanium and how much of those isotopes, what their activity is, what energies we worry about as essentially the isotope de-excites. So 30 days exposure at the Earth's surface and 1 year of storage below ground, and this is still what's left. So any experiment that would have some kind of material that they're worried about, activation, would do a calculation like this. And so essentially what this is called is it's essentially like it's a budget that you have. And so as you're thinking about your crystal, like from the time you're growing it, you're transporting it, you're fabricating your detector out of it, you have 30 days of equivalent exposure at the surface. And then you can store it and this is 1 year storage below ground. It's not like really deep. This isn't like storing it deep underground at Snow Lab. This is like, putting 15 or 20 meters water equivalent overburden over it to reduce it. This just basically gives you a background budget and what you have to work with. And so you have to think about moving your materials, fabricating, and meeting all sorts of deadlines. Yes?
What's the amount of activity in becquerels per kilogram that would be alarming for material? And an amount that you would disagree with?
So that all depends. So the idea of putting together, as you're thinking about building your detector, putting together all these budgets, is that you look, you like make some assumptions of what you think you can tolerate, and then you start trading. So like it would be like a budget in your household, right? So like if your rent goes up $10 a month, right? Are you alarmed? Like you would take that $10 and you maybe, not go to the movies once or once a month. Like you would swap things around in your budget. And so I would say, depending on what it is, you would probably want to have tolerances, where no single component, unless it really is just the one component that dominates, you can't do better for. I mean, you wouldn't want it to dominate your budget in any way. You'd prefer to have it, I would say if it was 5% of my background budget, I'd be really alarmed. If it was 1%, I'd probably feel like I could absorb that easily. If it gets higher, it's troublesome. To let you know, originally we were talking about a 60-day at surface exposure in SuperCDMS, just to give you an idea. So that would essentially be, doubling it is not quite right because it's, a radioactive decay. And it was our review committees who insisted that we had to go to a 30-day exposure, and it was challenging to make sure that we could fabricate and get everything with that 30-day exposure. But this takes into account that like when you take the crystals, like the crystals in SuperCDMS, they were pulled and so essentially grown in Belgium. So they were grown at the company, and then they were put in this underground facility called Hades. where they were stored essentially at this underground facility until they were ready to ship. When they shipped, and I don't have the slides in here, they shipped in the, but I do have pictures of it. If someone's interested, I could pull them out for tomorrow. This shipping container, it came from the GERDA experiment, which is a neutrinoless double beta decay experiment. And it's essentially a lead line container with poly and stuff. So open it up and you put the detectors in or the crystals in, and then it gets shipped that in a shipping cart, and it gets shipped via ship across the Atlantic Ocean because that does less exposure for this activation than if you flew it in a plane. Fly in a plane, your budget's shot. Okay, so no planes. So you take the slow boat to Savannah, Georgia, where you go through customs, And then it's put on a truck, okay? And then the truck takes the long route to California, going south of the Rocky Mountains, because even though that adds days onto the trucking trip, it's less exposure in terms of what we care about than going over the Rocky Mountains. So you see, so then they're fabricated, you know, back underground at Stanford, has an underground storage facility, back up to Slack, fabricate, back underground, you know, then sit, store it underground until we're ready to ship to Canada. And so they get assembled into a tower, you get ready to ship to Canada. You rent a truck, like a semi-truck, that has nothing on it except for the towers, and they drive straight through. So you have two drivers, essentially. So you can pay FedEx to do this. And then and you tell them the route, right? You put your sensor on, tell them the route, and they follow it. And so again, you're doing the slow drive down around the south of the Rocky Mountains, because remember, they extend up into Canada. And then you're, you know, coming up, I think they went through, not Sault Ste. Marie, but Detroit, I think is where they crossed the border. But anyway, you get the point, right? It's, and then when they get here, you know, we try to get them underground safely and quickly within a storage time. We even had a backup storage site at one time in case they couldn't get underground right away, where we could store them in Sudbury. Sorry. I think I keep confusing Sudan and Sudbury. I apologize. Too many S sounds, but Snow Lab, Sudbury. So that's sort of the long story, and it sort of kind of goes to your point, like at what point do you find it alarming? And it kind of shows you the measures that we go through to avoid, even like going over the Rocky Mountains might not have even occurred to you as being like something to be that concerned about, but it is. So those sorts of logistics I never thought I would do as a physicist. So
yeah, I've heard that some experiments, they get Roman lead that's been underwater.
Yeah, so we had some of this in when we were operating in Sudan. But we're not using that kind of, we call it archaeological lead in Canada. And actually, I don't know if I'm going to cover this or not in this next slide, but it goes to building the shield. So maybe I will get to the stories of that coming up. I was going to say another story too is, so when Nexo 200 was being fabricated, this was another one. It had very stringent requirements on radioactivity and cleanliness and various things. And so when I was a postdoc at Stanford, there was another postdoc, Andrea Pocar, who's quite involved in the Nexo program, even the next one, Nexo, not just Exo. But when he was a postdoc on Exo, part of his job, he would have to like fly to Southern California to go like supervise and do quality checks on like a weekly or biweekly basis of the company that was fabricating some of their readout cables, just to make sure that the specifications were being adhered to. Again, things I think you never thought you might have to do as a scientist, but when your experiment is this sensitive and you really need it to run right, these are the types of extremes you go to. All right, so moving on to environmental backgrounds, which is where the Roman or ancient lead comes into account. So typically underground, gamma ray and cosmic and radiogenic neutron fluxes, they're reduced really quite well, but there are still other things that we worry about. So even though they're reduced, they're not completely gone, and so you still need to continue to do it. So most experiments will use a combination of high Z and low Z materials to diminish both the neutron and gamma fluxes. So that would include lead, polyethylene, and copper. And so, and let me actually just show this whole slide as I talk through it rather than doing it bullet by bullet. All right, so in super CDMS here, you can see this is where you have the poly to moderate the neutrons. And then you have this lead layer here, which protects you against the poly. And so this is like catching gamma rays and stuff. The lead itself is radioactive. It has a half-life, lead 206 has a half-life of 26 and a half years, I believe it is. And so this very inner portion here is archaeological lead. So this would be lead that, you know, is over 100 years old. So it's gone through about four half-life cycles in that point. and has a lot of then the inherent background decayed. So this inner layer protects from this outer layer. And then there's an inner layer of poly that again is protecting, you know, from things that are happening in the lead. And then inside there's copper that's ultra clean. So you can see Majorana uses similar types of things. LZ and Lux, Xenon 110, all of them have water infrastructure to help reduce it. So it's both radioactivity and muon-induced neutrons. And so the question is just kind of taking a look at what this can do to you. So this again is from an older paper, but taking a look at, this is just a germanium detector underground with no shield. It's actually, I believe, so we have these germanium counters that are used to characterize different types of materials. There are a number of them. It's a really popular instrument for background studies. So this is one of those germanium counters that's underground, or that's underground but has no shield. And then when you add a lead shield and then a purge also for the radon, you end up with a much lower shield. So you can see the rates just keep going down as you add more and more types of mitigation for your background. Liquid nobles, in particular xenon, is great for this, argon as well. They have self-shielding properties. And so what you can see, so this here is from, this is from the LZ experiment, this is just an example. So this is sort of looking at the detector in half. So this is the center of the detector. Think of it as a soup can, and this is the very, very center point. So this is a radius of zero. And then as you go out, you know, this is the outermost side of the vessel. And so you'd have to imagine this wraps all the way around you, right? So what you can see is that this is just background events. And what you can see is here in the middle, it's really, really clean. And so xenon, argon, these liquid nobles, they have a self-shielding property. So if you make them big enough, they'll shield their backgrounds out. I mean, of course, you have a detector like this, you'd really rather do something to make it even cleaner. And so in LZ, they've put on like a clean skin around their detector, and they also have this outer detector veto that's going on. And when they add those things, it, you know, totally cleans up even more of their detector as far as their shielding goes. So they go from having essentially just by adding that outer detector, adding, you know, they call it a skin that helps to mitigate these backgrounds. They go from a 3.8 ton fiducial mass to a 5.6 ton fiducial mass.
So the white means that it didn't detect anything?
Exactly. I don't remember, I don't remember what the time scale was for these specific measurements. This is LZ. I don't remember. Let me see if my notes say anything here. Yeah, I don't have anything in my notes about the time that they were assuming for this. All right. So the next thing that we worry about, so we've been worrying about a lot of things. So now it's the internal radioactivity that we care about. So this would be the radioactivity that is in the materials that you construct your detector or your shielding out of. So uranium-238, thorium-238, potassium-40, cesium, cobalt, argon, krypton, the list goes on and on. These types of decays in the detector materials are also problematic. And so what happens here is that basically you take a number of different types of methods to screen or characterize your materials before you use them. So it could be a screening in sort of like you're looking for a vendor who produces a material of a certain quality that you're looking at, and then when you find it, you buy a big lot. Or it could be that you're actually doing quality assurance, so you have the material, but you know the background that you're worried on is worried about is on the surface of the material. So can I clean the material in a way that makes it better and not worse? And so you could do quality assurance. So the real key here is that in most cases, we're looking for materials that have less than one part per billion of these things. And so that's pretty tough. And this is just a picture for you. I think especially as theorists, you probably don't get to get into labs to see these types of equipment all the time. So let me just point out a couple of them. This is my XIA alpha counter that I had in my clean room when I was at SMU in Dallas. We have one of these at Snow Lab, and we might procure this one as well. This is high purity germanium counting with the gopher experiment, gopher counter. That counter was at Sudan. I think this actually got moved. This got moved to Snow Lab when the Sudan mine shut down some time ago. Well, the science lab did, at least. This is a beta screener that they have at South Dakota School of Mines. Both of these together is radon emanation at PNNL. And by the way, these are just examples. Like, lots of facilities have these types of counters. I just was trying to be sort of inclusive. This counter is kind of neat in that there's like this whole cool control board for actually taking the measurement. But really, when you do the measurement, you're putting it into this sort of cell. And then you take this cell and hook it up to a computer to read out the measurement. And then ICPMS, that's at Gran Sasso. Like I said, so there's a whole suite of instruments that we use for it. And so just kind of out of curiosity, you know, how well we can do. So high purity germanium counting is sort of the workhorse of doing a lot of this background stuff. And so essentially there's two ways that this works. You either buy a commercial system and you augment it by building a custom shield to go around it. And that shield would be designed of lead, copper, other neutron capturing types of materials and be put underground. Or you can purchase a fully custom system that has a shield and a number of other elements in place that minimize the uranium, thorium, and potassium. And so what you can see is that, it does pretty good. It kind of depends how much money you want to spend and who does the work. So the alpha and beta screening. The alpha screening is kind of pretty cool in that essentially this is just like it's not a wire chamber, but it's like a drift chamber. So you have a sample that sits on a tray, and then the alphas decay off of that sample. And basically by doing pulse shape analysis, you can tell whether the alpha particle you're counting originated from the tray, one of the walls, or if it just came, you know, from outside, like the gas itself we've actually seen at SMU. And the beta screener is another very sensitive instrument. It's a custom-built instrument between South Dakota School of Mines and Caltech worked on it together that does really great things. And, you know, I can already see the eyes are glazing over. I've just shown you too many cool toys, so I'm not gonna show you anymore. I'm just gonna point out that we have lots and lots of things that I'm not showing you, that kind of work towards this. Okay, so.
I hate toys.
You hate toys. Okay, maybe we'll get back to something you like a little better, software. Okay. All right, so. So after you play with your toys and you get your measurements, then the next step is that you need to model your backgrounds. And so the modeling of backgrounds actually happens through multiple types of frameworks, okay? So it's not like you go into JAINT and you're like, here's my detector, JAINT, and I want to know what is the answer. It turns out it's a little bit more complicated than that. I'm going to start with alpha ends. So it turns out alpha ends are something that you can't just do in JAINT. You have to feed JAINT a spectrum that then can go into your detector to get things happening. And so that spectrum you actually have to get from some different software. And so there are essentially three software frameworks that exist that calculate the spectra of neutrons that are produced by alpha N interactions. I would say the most widely used one is called Sources. And it's amazing because even Sources, even and then there's also this University of South Dakota made a web tool. And then there is something newer called C, or new CBOT, which was, I believe, created by, I think, Sean Westdale from when he was working on Deep, had written this framework, but I might be wrong. But the interesting part about all three of these, this one is actually maintained by one of the government labs in the United States that does nuclear things. All of them are not complete by themselves. Like, they're not just like complete frameworks from head to tail. All of them take libraries as inputs to the calculations. And the libraries are essentially derived from measurements that are made. So for example, Sources uses a library called Empire to get its cross-section inputs. The USD web tool uses something called Tendel, and the Tendel library is validated by another library called Talus. And so these are just different libraries that exist, so Empire, Tendel, and Talus, that are the inputs to the cross-sections used to produce your interactions. So the advantage of Tendel, it's validated against Talus. Empire is the one that's recommended by the International Atomic Energy Agency. But neither one of them actually works really great. So that's sort of where we are. I can just to give you an idea. So a postdoc that I had at SMU that worked with me, and Kim Palladino and one of my graduate students, we went on a crusade for a little bit to try to understand some of these differences, like try to produce a paper that would validate some of these things and show the differences. These are sort of the results. and I don't know that any specific result means anything. But the basic takeaway is that the study we did found that there were no major systematic differences between, this here was comparing the USD web tool and Sources for C. In terms of the spectra, the output spectra, and the yield, and both had errors in cross sections, outputs, and those errors required a human eye in order to catch. Yes.
For this study, you looked at only the chains between 238 and 232. Mm-hmm. Are those the most important chains to worry about?
These are the most important chains to most experiments. I would say the next thing like that perhaps gets worried about is potassium, but it's much at a minor level. And the potassium, like, it would really get you if you like touched a detector with your hands. If you did, like, it's your hands are probably the biggest contributor. So, you know, being gloved is helpful. But these are the two major isotopes that people worry about in their detector materials. So at the time this paper came out, new CBOT did not quite exist in its full form. So when new CBOT came in, it was Sean Westerdale who wrote there, who did this study then comparing new CBOT to Sources for C. And so this is in the context of this software was being used by DEEP to predict the neutrons in their materials of interest, and ultimately, you know, you can see the results that they got between the two different methods are quite similar overall in the total number that were coming out. All right, so now you have your neutron spectra, and Jayant can produce some of the other spectra you need. So now you're ready to actually take your background spectra and propagate them through your instrument to see what you get. And so, like, again, this is all the things you need to do and think about before it is that you can do your profile likelihood or do any of these sophisticated analyses. You have to do all this work on the backgrounds first. So JAMP4 is the simulation tool of choice here. So this would produce basically your anticipated background spectra after you run it through your detector. So this is the super CDMS geometry that's in JAMP4. And this here is showing you the spectra of a germanium iZip. This here is the spectra, and these are the different backgrounds that you're looking at here. So this here is the spectra that you would anticipate after you've run it through your simulation, before you did any kind of analysis cuts. And then if you do some rough cuts, you end up here. And again, I want to go back to that idea of, you know, how do you see your dark matter on top of all of these backgrounds? So in this here dashed line is a 1 GeV WIMP signal that you would have to find from all these backgrounds. This is your 10 GeV WIMP signal for comparison. So you can see that, you know, once you add your background cuts, you actually have a hope of seeing a signal. And so essentially, I said these are really loose cuts. This is only fiducialization, essentially, and your ionization yield. All right. So great. You have all this stuff now, and you're ready to go. You know what your criteria are. All these collaborations, especially in the size they are now and at the expense they are now, are keeping background inventories of their components and their required purity. And so this type of tool is the type of tool that you can use when you need to go out and actually procure your materials and select your vendors. And then if something comes up, like you were talking about, like something unexpectedly is coming back high, you can use tools like this to try to see if you have enough leeway in your budget that you can trade, if you will, trade background requirements and still make the experiment work. I have no idea why this slide is called background inventory, because it is not. this is supposed to say, so what happens if you go out, you do your background, you can't find the material you need. Sometimes it turns out that you actually can't find a vendor that can meet your specifications. And so you might not find copper that can meet your specifications. And so you actually have to like make your own. At PNNL and other facilities have this capability. We're hoping to someday get this capability at Snow Lab. They electroform copper. And so if you make your copper yourself, you electroform it underground, you can really do remarkable things and get very, 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 very clean copper. It's expensive, though. Like, you know, a sheet like this in diameter is like $10,000. So, the other place where oftentimes you have to do something is when you're dealing with the liquid noble gases or liquid noble gases, that's a dichotomy. The liquid noble experiments that have liquid nobles, those materials have inherent backgrounds in them. So for example, commercial xenon contains one part per million to 10 parts per billion of krypton. But xenon, one ton, for example, requires 0.2 parts per trillion. So basically, they had to build a distillation column in order to remove the krypton from the xenon that's in there. Similarly, if argon's your favorite, argon-39 is another problem. And this is a picture from Dark Side, not 20K, but the previous incarnation, where they built a still to help remove argon-39. Now, there are plants. There's this whole deep underground argon business that's going on now, where they have found sort of reservoirs of argon underground that doesn't have this as much of this component. It's really pure, and so there's a whole. Yeah, there's like a whole talk you could give on that facility and how they work. So they have a facility in Colorado, and I think they have another facility in Sardinia. So finally, you make all of this happens, and then you get through everything that you're doing, and you still have backgrounds, right? The neutrino backgrounds are the next thing that are going to get us, or if you're optimistic, the neutrino signal, you know, it could be the first measurement of solar neutrinos in germanium. I'm seeing a discovery in our future. But the point is that there are these solar neutrino backgrounds that the detectors are just getting so sensitive now that soon we're going to start seeing solar neutrinos. So there are low energies, high fluxes, and they'll contribute to the electron recoil background. There's also neutrino-induced nuclear recoils that can't be distinguished from WIMPs that are going to come from boron 8 solar neutrinos. There's also the atmospheric neutrinos and diffuse supernova neutrinos. All of these things will come to haunt us at some point. So, our needs. So we need the ability to see these low energy WIMPs that induce nuclear recoils on the order of under less than 10 to tens of KeV. We need things to be radiologically pure. We need the detectors to be able to go to low thresholds. We need the ability to distinguish nuclear recoils and electron recoils. This becomes really helpful even once you see a signal. Even if it is, let's say I've been talking a lot about a nuclear recoiling dark matter candidate like a WIMP, but even if it is that we end up seeing one that recoils on an electron, like we see a hint of a signal, we see things that are unexpected, knowing whether that dark matter is interacting with a nucleus or interacting with an electron, that tells us something about its properties. So either way, being able to distinguish between the two is important. Yes.
So what does the S mean? Like, is like 10 KeV to 10 S?
Tens of KeV. So like 30 KeV. So under 10 to tens of KeV. We have to pay attention to radiogenic and cosmogenic background mitigation. So passive and or active shielding, position reconstruction and fiducialization, characterization of the backgrounds, and long exposures with long-term stability, especially when we start looking for annual or diurnal modulation. So I think this summarizes what we've talked about for the last 2 days. So with that in hand, let's take a look at the search space. All right, so whether you're a particle physicist, so you think in picobarns, or if you're a dark matter physicist and we think in terms of centimeters squared, and then your WIMP mass and GeV. All right, so it doesn't really matter the details of these dots. These dots are just different points in different theories under different assumptions. So in particular, this is all a constrained minimal supersymmetry model, where there are different assumptions or different priors might be taken into account, and then there's kind of a dot for each one of them just to give you an idea. You could have a PMSSM. Over here, let's see, the purple is, next to minimal supersymmetry model. And if you're curious about any of these colors, like I can read it off to you. It has to do with Beano and Higgsinos and whatever model you're taking yet. So these are still feasible. In blue here is sort of highlighting areas where if you take an asymmetric dark matter model, you can extend this into lower energies. All right, so there's a huge parameter space with different models. This roughly tells you the space that we've already excluded. So you can see that there still are models out there to be explored. So what we want to do in the future is we want to pull this side, we want it to go lower in mass and also lower in cross-section. And here, these experiments, we'd like to have them moving towards the neutrino fog to the point where they no longer can give us, you know, interesting information regarding dark matter. Yes?
Where would the neutrino background be on this plot?
Okay, so this is where the fog gets a little foggy, if you will. Let me, so the thing with the fog is that depending on what your target is, the neutrino background or the neutrino fog comes in at a different level, okay? So let me do a quick, I think I have a plot. I might have a plot, let me say. There, let me show you this one here, just quickly. So this plot here kind of gives you a sense of the fog and future experiments. So I think it's perhaps more helpful. It doesn't have all the models on it, but so this here is roughly where it is, and it could move a bit, like I said, depending on what you're looking at. And this particular plot here, the solid lines are the exclusions, and these dashed lines over here are all sensitivities, projected sensitivities that were given to the people who keep this program by the experiments themselves. So, you know, that's, you have to trust them at that level. And so what you can see is I think when you start talking about like an ultimate, this GADMC, this is like an argon, a global argon dark matter consortium right now, who's thinking about a future detector. So this line is for germanium. And so for argon, I believe it's a little bit higher. So this detector here would get into the argon fog, is projected to go into the argon fog. You know, they're all kind of in this sort of area. The xenon, let's see here. So this dashed line here is a future sort of xenon ton scale experiment, or xenon n-ton. These are all getting pretty close to the fog. Okay, any other questions before we start moving on to another topic? That is the end of backgrounds. Okay, so I think with the 10 minutes, we can address the question you were asking a little bit about. Yesterday you were asking if we could talk a little bit more about Dama Libra. All right, so the Dama Libra experiment have been reporting, or collaboration, they've been reporting positive results since 1998. So they've been observing dark matter for a very long time, they think. So DAMA was the original experiment. It was a 100 kilogram array of sodium iodide crystals that was operated in Gran Sasso until 2002. They then upgraded their experiment to something called Libra, which was a 250 kilogram array, and that's been operating since 2003, with their first results reported in 2008. They measure scintillation only, so they don't measure ionization, it's just scintillation from particle interactions in their detectors. So they have no discrimination between nuclear recoils and electron recoils. It's just scintillation that they're measuring. And so these are just some pictures. So this is one of, like we were talking about, the drive-in sort of laboratory. So if you're driving through the tunnel where Gran Sasso is through, it literally is like a little exit off the tunnel ramp. And so you can see, you know, sort of pictures of their detectors All right, so, yes.
No, I didn't have anything.
Oh, I thought you were raising your hand, sorry. All right, so I put some references up here. And by the way, I do plan to put all of these slides, the slides for each day, up on Indico. I just didn't get a chance to get them up from yesterday yet. So I'll put them up there if you are missing something or if you find them useful. All right, so this is essentially their data. So they are clearly seeing a modulation in their detector of events over 14 cycles, and this is at a level of 12.9 sigma. And it's in the 2 to 6 KeV bin. So they have a phase one. The phase two signal for single scatter events in the 1 to 6 KeV, so that's this plot here, I think, was observed over 6 cycles, so that's 9.5 signal background. So the problem is that they don't have any background to signal discrimination. We don't know if these events are nuclear recoils or electron recoils. Maybe it doesn't matter. And there has been a long debate over the background or dark matter interpretation. The problem is that the dark matter interpretation is in tension with every other experimental result. So, like, those plots I was showing you, like Dama Libra, their signal region isn't even really on them.
Is it mean by no background to signal discrimination?
Huh? Why?
No, what do you mean by that?
So background to signal discrimination. So generally speaking, okay, so let's say it was you're assuming a nuclear recoiling dark matter candidate. They can't tell the difference between a nuclear recoil and an electron recoil. So when people say, actually, this is kind of jargon we use, so I'm glad you asked about this, because it could be helpful when you're talking with people. When people say background discrimination, that always means they're talking about the being able to discriminate between nuclear recoils and electron recoils, and they're automatically kind of not considering, like in that conversation, it's probably 90% of the time they're not even considering an electron recoiling dark matter candidate. So the other problem with that is that there are disagreements on the background modeling that they have. So there are papers out there that have looked at a variety of things that this could be. And nobody has been able to come up with a model of some background that would explain their results. So
do they give access to their data to other people?
No.
Is that common practice, or is that
Not in the United States. The United States funding agencies require us to release our data. They don't have strict requirements about when, like a reasonable time, but essentially when you publish, it's customary that you also release your data. In our collaboration, we don't release the raw data. We release it in a form that's been calibrated so you can actually use it. Some collaborations, not ours, but some collaborations actually release their code in addition to their data. I think the Xenon N-Ton experiment does that, or the Xenon collaboration also release their code. More transparency. Dama has not released their data. I was at a conference. The UCLA Dark Matter Symposium happens every couple of years. Were you there? Yeah. And there was definitely this, it was almost like, I mean, there weren't posters and signs, but it almost felt like somebody was going to start raising a cardboard sign saying, free the data. it definitely got a little bit tense. I have, to be honest, that's the first time I've seen a discussion get that tense with Dama Libra in a very long time. Usually it's a bit more respectful and, I think, in general, just ignored. But I probably shouldn't be saying that in my new position. So I'm saying that as my professor hat. So it becomes really crazy. Nobody can explain. I mean, one of the things you might think is, like, can anybody think of something like a background that we talked about today that might modulate over the course of a year?
Where is this again?
This is in Gran Sasso.
Sorry.
The experiment's in Gran Sasso, Italy.
Okay.
Sorry, Gran Sasso is a lab in Italy.
Lots of things that correlate with seasons.
With seasons, yeah. So things that anything that could correlate with the seasons. So the muon flux. But it turns out that I think the muon flux for where they are is exactly opposite of what it should be. So muon flux doesn't work.
So why does the muon flux correlate with seasons?
I forget why. I mean, I think it has to do with like the way the Earth is tilting between summer and winter, and it, so it probably has something to do with them with the atmosphere, but.
Could just be some temperature effect.
It could be that. So you're right. It could be a temperature effect, but at an underground site, often underground, the temperatures don't vary seasonally as much as they do on the surface. But do you know what does have a seasonal dependence underground? A lot of times, your radon levels fluctuate between summer and winter. So I say this because people have looked at all of these things and nobody has been able to, like, these things are not an explanation for it, but I wanted you guys to start thinking a little bit about, you know, what, like, if you were thinking about this, like, what types of things would be the obvious things that you would first ask about? So this is a puzzle, and the puzzle, has been going on for a long time, and there's now a worldwide effort to try to understand this signal.
What strikes me is that it stayed consistent between the first run and the second run.
Yes.
If it is.
And, oh, and one of the things I say, actually, I don't know if it shows it on this plot or not. Let me take a look here. Sorry, I went the wrong way. Now I'm giving you, whoa, I'm really going the wrong way. Okay, so what I don't have on this plot here, or on this transparency, is the first DAMA, the results from DAMA alone. So when they initially were releasing their results, it was I think it was a 3 to 6 kV bin. I mean, I don't remember what the upper limit was. It was something small. But the important part is that 3 kV was their cutoff. And so there was this real concern that there was something going on at their threshold, especially because we know that 3 kV X-rays and Auger electrons are showing up around there. And if they're showing up, and depending on things, like, it seemed really important to, if it was at all possible, to see the next energy bin below, right? And what's going on there, to try to see, you know, what was happening. And so they did, when they did this result, this is why you see like 2 to 6 here, and why here, for the second phase, they opened it up down to 1 kEV, because they're trying to dispel any ideas that some lower energy X-ray might just be turning on or something, you know, that there's something going on in this low energy bin where it's not there, but it's in the next one, or there's tons of it, like, in the low energy bin, or, you know, so, yeah, but that, you know, we have to give them credit for that. So, a number of efforts have been going on. I don't believe DMICE is running anymore. They combined efforts with the KIMS experiment. There is KIMS and DMICE to become COSINE. So KIMS doesn't exist anymore either. And so that is a primarily US and Korean effort to reproduce it. DAMA has their DAMA Libra is still going. Sabra is another idea, and they want to put a detector in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere to study systematics that might come in. There's the ANISE experiment, PICOLON, and I realized missing. Oh nope, there it is. COSINUS is another one. COSINUS is essentially taking a detector much like the CREST dark matter detector and using it for detection as well. So there are a lot of people who are trying to do this, and they've been running long enough that they're starting to be able to get results that say something, but are not conclusive yet. And so, oh no, we're over time. You'll have to wait till tomorrow.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we had some really good discussions today. Tomorrow we'll talk some more about this Dama Libra puzzle. And in particular, so now you know what the problem is. You know there are people who are looking worldwide to try to replicate it. So tomorrow we'll go over experiments that have results and experiments that are in the process and what that means for the future. And then we'll go on and talk about the other experiments and what they're doing and what's going on. So hopefully we'll wrap that all up tomorrow. And then Friday, we'll try to get into neutrinos double beta decay. Depending on how things go, I think we'll wrap up tomorrow. I also am hoping to talk a little bit about these dark matter detectors and new technologies that are coming out, especially for lower mass dark matter. I think if you're interested in dark matter theory, that really seems to be the place that the kids are interested in nowadays. I know I was on a Science Friday episode once with a young faculty member from Riverside, and he was all like, and the old people, they lied to us. The WIMP doesn't exist. It's all this new stuff. And I'm there like, wait a minute. We're not quite there, but I agree. It's been a bit disappointing. So thank you, and I will see you all tomorrow.